So, as Hugh said, I'm currently involved in research, in doctoral research, looking at how the four Gospels that we have today, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, came together as a fourfold collection. There's a church father by the name of Irenaeus, which I suggested as a child's name, but my wife very kindly said, I will have to call that in the playground, so try it out for size. Anyway, this church father named Irenaeus had this sort of vision. Well, he writes about the vision from Ezekiel of the four living creatures with wings circling the throne of God. And he likens those four living creatures to the four Gospels. So I like to say that I'm trying to figure out how the four living creatures, the four Gospel birds of a feather, started to flock together. Or as the four Gospel boy band began to make power ballads into the second and third centuries. I tried that joke on my generation, where we had cool songs in the 90s, and I guess the Backstreet Boys aren't cool anymore. So, all right, but we have an important question to dive into. Can we trust the Gospels? Now, I'd like to start out by saying that the Gospels are not neutral documents. They're not unbiased, sort of boring Wikipedia articles, although there are no unbiased Wikipedia articles. They're not neutral documents that are just for pleasure reading. They are making very, very strong claims. They're exalting a crucified Messiah, someone who opposed one of the strongest empires in world history, the Roman Empire, someone who was crucified on their weapon of torture, the Roman cross, someone who his followers claimed to see him risen from the dead, and someone whose teachings demand from the entire world that they follow him and only in him find true hope and true life. They're not neutral documents. So, we can't just leave them to the side. Because they have a strong message, we must confront them. They confront us. And so, it is entirely appropriate to put the Gospels on trial and ask, can they be trusted? They're either deeply deceptive, trying to deceive us, claiming to make truth claims, but knowing that they're false, or they're well-intentioned but delusional, or they are indeed true. So, let's put the Gospels on trial and ask, can they be trusted? Now, our question tonight is, importantly, we should emphasize there, that the question is, can we trust the Gospels, not can we prove the Gospels? We're not going to do sort of scientific experiments where we can have a body of data and put them under a microscope and be able to have 100% indubitable proof that these are true, like we would, prove the chemical compounds making up the wine that you're drinking today. In fact, if we think about it, most of our thinking, most of our everyday life is not based on 100% proof. A very lovely man I just met. Was it Peter who served me my coffee? Yes. Where's my coffee? So I don't have 100% proof that you haven't poisoned my coffee. But I'm almost done with it, so if I heal over, it's that way we know what happened. But anyway, I trust Hugh. Hugh trusts Peter, right? Yes. Hugh trusts Peter. Because I trust Hugh and Hugh trusts Peter, I trust Peter to give me a cup of coffee that's not poisoned. I didn't prove it by putting it under the microscope, but I relied on the trust. Or think about the chairs that each of you are sitting on right now. Have you examined their structural stability, or did you just sort of lean all your weight into them at one time? We spend a lot of our life dependent upon trust, a firm belief in the reliability of a truth or the reliability of a person. So what I want to ask tonight is if we can trust the Gospels, if beyond reasonable doubt, so not 100% proof, but beyond reasonable doubt, can we trust the Gospels? I love Dorothy Sayers, and beyond reasonable doubt is a phrase that comes across in almost all of her novels about murder mysteries. It's about trust. It's about a level of uncertainty that as human beings bound by space and time, we can't go beyond that level of uncertainty at this time. But it's also about looking at the testimony of what we're examining, putting it to the test, and then seeing, can we indeed trust it? So there's three kinds of questions that are involved in this underlying question, can we trust the Gospels? The first is, can we trust the Gospel authors? The authors who wrote Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, can we trust that they give us, or so do they give us evidence beyond reasonable doubt that they are communicating historical truth? Secondly, not only the authors of the Gospels, but the people who received the books when they published them in the ancient world and they distributed them, those people known as the church, can we trust that church to have handed down to us those gospel texts faithfully for 2,000 years? So can we trust the gospel authors? Can we trust the church to have handed down to us the gospels? And finally, can we trust the capital A author of these gospels? Can we trust the Jesus who is speaking, who the authors claim is speaking through these gospels? Can we trust him that he is communicating truth that can save our lives, that can give us hope, that can come good on the promises that he claims to be able to give to us in these gospels? So can we trust the authors? Can we trust the church to have distributed these gospels? And can we trust the allegedly divine voice behind these gospels? So can we trust the gospels? Yes, is what I will argue tonight. And there are four reasons that I want to unpack tonight. I'm going to riff on this because there's a lot of information. Don't worry, it's not going to be line by line. There's four reasons that I want to unpack are, first, that the Gospels are based on eyewitness testimony. Second, that the Gospels faithfully preserve the words and deeds of the Jesus of history, Jesus of Nazareth, who lived in the first century. Third, that the text of the Gospels was faithfully transmitted, the actual manuscripts and the text written written on papyri, those texts were faithfully transmitted. And finally, reason number four, the Gospels are beautiful. They present to us a picture of the world that makes sense of evil, sin, justice, and human flourishing. So, how long do I have here? Just to double check here. Until 8:24, because we at least don't have our questions, right? Just to double check. Okay, great. So, let's tackle this first one. The Gospels are ancient historiography. So, ancient writers writing history, probably biographies, written within living memory of the events based on eyewitness testimony. Okay, let's just pick one of the Gospels. Luke, the Gospel according to Luke, chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. It says, the author writes, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. So he's not claiming to write an epic like Homer's Odyssey or the Iliad. He's not claiming to write sort of popular novels like what was known as the Alexander Romance of that era. He wasn't claiming to write mythography. So, you know, fable stories about Zeus, about Neptune, about, you just name the whole pantheon of ancient Greek gods. He was claiming to write history of a real historical man named Jesus Christ, and he was claiming to write that history based on the people who lived with Jesus, walked with him, talked with him, heard him speak, remembered his speeches, and recollected those in community. Now, it's important to note that the four Gospels, they give us ample evidence to believe that they were written within 40 to 80 years after the event. Now, that might seem like a long time, but if we think about how human memory, especially memory in community, works, 40 years to 80 years, there are still what we call living memories of a historical person. As I was on the train today, I actually thought of an example for the first time, because I've been teaching my son how to play chess. Does anybody in this room play chess? Okay, one chess player? Okay. There's a opening known as the Roy Lopez. It's pawn to e4. So the white moves first, you move your pawn forward here, then the black moves, pawn matches it, then the horse guy and the knight kind of does an L, then the knight does another L, then your bishop moves this way. Do you know how old that chess opening is? Take a wild guess. Oh, it's not that old, but it's so about 1491. There's what's called the Göttingen manuscript that actually has this very same opening preserved. This is over 500 years. Now, I didn't consult the Göttingen manuscript when I learned that. I didn't even look at a chess book when I learned that opening. My father taught me that opening, and I am teaching my son that opening. There is a reliability of that chess opening transition because it involves speech, it involves hand movements, it involves a loving relationship. It involves emotional experiences when I lost chess tournaments and started crying. It involved elated experience when I won chess tournaments. I got a little trophy, you know. It involves really strong childhood memories, and so I can do that chess opening in my sleep now. Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, he took bread and broke it and gave it to his disciples and said, "Take and eat. This is my body given for you for the forgiveness of sins." In the same way, after the supper, he took the cup and said, "This is my blood of the new covenant, which is given for you. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me." The disciples, with their very physical hands, took that bread and distributed it one to another. And for decades after Jesus allegedly died and rose again, they practiced that again and again and again. They practiced it in Jerusalem. They practiced it in, in Syria, in Antioch. I'm kind of following a map of the Mediterranean basin here. They practiced it in Hierapolis here. They crossed modern-day Turkey going into the European continent. Yes, they crossed it. They did it in Corinth. They did it in Thessaloniki. They did it in Rome. And arguably, they did it all the way into Spain. Within a couple decades of Jesus' death, these traditions spanned the Mediterranean basin and were remembered and re-remembered and recollected. And these apostles were eyewitnesses of these events. And so it's not the same as telephone. Some people have used this analogy to say, you know, if Hugh says to his neighbor, you know, one message to the neighbor to the next neighbor, person to person to person, by the time you get to the end of the room there, the message has completely changed. It's much different because there's a relationship with the historical figure. There is a vested interest to preserve the memory of that historical figure. There's the embodied mechanism for remembering it by practicing it with a community. And there's the wide geographic distribution of that memory. Now, there are also different cultural customs and ways in which the ancient world would remember things. And we see signs of those genuine eyewitness testimonies in the Gospels. So this is, what is this? I should have put page numbers. This is page 2. So right above reason number 2, sort of midway in there. signs of legitimate eyewitness testimony. We have geography, we have topography, we have personal names, we have socio-political and cultural contexts, we have everything from botanical, horticultural, finance, and fisherman's terms. These are genuine first century characteristics of someone who lived in that region and in that place and at that time. Now, I just met someone before who had studied at Oxford in the late 90s, and at that time, Wadham College didn't have residences down Iffley Road, did they? Those were just built last year. Okay. So, if someone wrote a history of 18th century Oxford, right, and they said, say their protagonist was named, Kanye, okay? First of all, the name Kanye probably is not an 18th century Oxford name, okay? And then they said Kanye went to Keble College. Well, Keble College was founded in the 19th century, okay? But he's trying to write an 18th century history. And then this friend went to the Wadham College residence on Iffley Road. I wonder if Iffley Road even existed at that time. You can see that this person, this sort of hypothetical historian, is using 21st century names to try to describe a 17th or 18th century Oxford history. We would immediately realize, oh, this is anachronistic. This doesn't match the place, doesn't match the time. We see the exact opposite when we read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They name 26 town and city names, most of which are confirmed by contemporaneous historians like Josephus or by rabbinic sources. The authors, think about this, in the ancient world, they didn't have Google Maps. They didn't even have maps, unless you were an elite, part of the elite echelons of society. You didn't have access to a map. And so if you lived in, north of Rome, say you lived in northern Italy, you wouldn't know that a place named Cana existed outside of Galilee, or a small village named Bethany outside of Jerusalem. Or you wouldn't know that Jerusalem is higher in altitude than Jericho. And so you wouldn't know to say Jesus and his disciples went down from Jerusalem to Jericho, or down from Nazareth to Capernaum, or up from Capernaum to Nazareth. But this is what the gospel authors consistently say. If you weren't in first century Jerusalem, you wouldn't know that there is a place called the Solomon's Colonnade. Okay, who has been to Oxford? Has anybody seen the Martyr Memorial, right? Yes, right by St. Mary Magdalene's church. I had a friend visit Oxford and said, hey, I'll meet you at the Martyr Memorial. I was like, oh, where's that? Oh, wait a second. Google. They found it in 10 seconds. They didn't have that in the ancient world. And so naming specific places like Solomon's Colonnade or Gabbatha or a Field of Blood or Golgotha or the Mount of Olives or the Sheep's Gate, these kinds of physical locations give us strong indications that at least, at the very least, beyond reasonable doubt, the persons who wrote these gospels either knew those places personally or consulted people who knew those places personally. Not only so, but knew those places at those times, because geography changed in the ancient world. Jerusalem was leveled, was raised in 70 AD when the Romans under Titus came and to destroy things. Again, it was destroyed even more extensively in 132 AD when, who was that? It was Hadrian came and just decimated and even renamed the city of Jerusalem. So someone writing a gospel, say 150 AD, would have had two destructions of Jerusalem between him and the person of Jesus. And so it would have looked much different than someone who wrote the gospel in 70 or 80 or 90 AD, who knew people who were actually there in those places and at those times. Here's another thing. Personal name. So I just, off the top of my head, chose the name Kanye. Just maybe because I saw the news stuff that Kanye West is doing. But silly example. There was a name, you know, 21st century name that doesn't match up with what example I gave of an 18th century Oxonian. But we see the opposite dynamic when we see the names used in the Gospels, especially when you have what we can call disambiguation. So a name, sort of like with Wikipedia. So today what did I look up in Wikipedia? I looked up Roy Lopez, you know, because I wanted to figure out when this chess opening was invented. And I had to disambiguate, do I want the chess opening or do I want the historical person, Roy Lopez? So that's called disambiguation. You kind of specify what you're exactly looking for. When it comes to names, the way we disambiguate names today is by our last name. So there's a lot of Jacobs in the world, so I'm Jacob Rodriguez. There's a lot of Jacob Rodriguezes in the world, so I'm Jacob A. Rodriguez. There's a lot of Jacob A. Rodriguezes in the world, so I'm Jacob A. Rodriguez from Macomb, Michigan. So there's different ways to disambiguate my name. The more common my name is, the more important it is that I have a disambiguating factor in my name. So let me list several names. Simon Peter, Judas Iscariot, Mary Magdalene, James, the brother of Jesus, James and John, the sons of Zebedee. Okay? James, Peter, Simon, Mary, even Jesus. Jesus, son of Joseph of Nazareth. Those are five of the most common names in first century Palestine. And so someone who did not know first century Palestinian culture would not have known, oh, I have to disambiguate if I say there is a Peter, you know. But someone who lived at that place at that time would say, and then Peter said to Jesus, or Simon said to Jesus, Simon said to Jesus, you are the Christ, the Son of God. Someone living at that place at that time would say, okay, if I only say Simon, it could be Simon from Galilee, or Simon from Nazareth, or Simon from Capernaum, or Simon from Cana, or Simon from Sepphoris, or Simon from any of these places, because there's so many oodles of Simons in first century Palestine. So I'm going to say Simon Peter said to Jesus. All that to say, the names kind of show us that the persons who wrote the Gospels, they not only knew the geography, they not only knew the topography, they also knew the cultural context and the names of people who lived in those places and at those times. Beyond reasonable doubt, it appears to me that these Gospels give us the evidence of first century testimony. So, to conclude this first reason, the Christian movement claimed early on that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were written by these eyewitnesses or immediate associates of eyewitnesses. And Luke, as I quoted in Luke chapter 1, and John claimed this explicitly. In fact, let me sort of take a side note here. I quoted Luke chapter 1. Let me quote from John chapter 1, verse 14. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory. And what he means there is they've actually seen the person Jesus and seen him dead and seen him resurrected. That's what it's claiming. Or John chapter 19, verses 36 through 37. This is when blood and water flow from Jesus' side, when the Roman soldier throws the spear into his side. John says emphatically, the one who sees this knows that his testimony is true. So either he's lying to us, trying to deceive us, or he is deeply deluded, or he is indeed telling us the truth. John chapter 21, verses 24 through 25, the last two verses in the Gospel of John, also declare that the disciple whom Jesus loved saw these things and bears witness to them. And so, Luke and John, those two Gospels that we have, they explicitly claim to come from eyewitnesses, and Matthew and Mark also give evidence that they are based on eyewitness testimony beyond reasonable doubt, and that they derive from those first century residents of Galilee and Jerusalem. And therefore, I believe it is reasonable to conclude that the stories in the Gospels derive from those first century followers of Jesus. Okay, so if they're derived from eyewitness testimony, then it would be reasonable to then ask the following question: is that eyewitness testimony faithfully preserving the words and deeds of Jesus? How reliable are those eyewitness testimonies? It's pretty likely that there were eyewitness testimonies, but how reliable are they? Okay, when we look at the nature of eyewitness testimony, especially testimony in the ancient world, oftentimes historians, skeptical historians, can apply a very, very rigorous standard, saying, unless we can be 100% certain, or very, very certain at least, that we have the exact words of Jesus, then we cannot be sure at all that any of it is reliable. We have to find, we have to be able to prove that we have the exact words of Jesus. Now, I'd like to argue that even though I don't think we have, in many cases, and maybe even in most cases, the exact words of Jesus by certain standards, we do have the exact voice of Jesus. What Jesus used to say, what he would say, what he would say again and again, even if it wasn't at a specific time at that specific location, this is what he used to say so often that this is what he is properly remembered to have said. Let me give an example from my own life. So I had the joy, the privilege of living in the Horn of Africa, in Ethiopia, for about 5 years. For 2.5 of those years, I traveled across Ethiopia, across the countryside, teaching in local churches, teaching under acacia trees, out in the open, inside buildings, raining, shining, whatever the weather was. We traveled, me and my colleagues, and taught. We had a certain course that we taught, a 3-day course, where we taught people how to love their Muslim neighbors, how to share the love of Christ with them. Now, that specific training that I did, we had this, it was the same content, but we did it place after place after place. We never did the same teaching with the exact same words. Never in two occasions was it the exact same words. But 40, 50, 60 years from now, if you talk to people in each of those cities, those towns, those villages, and ask them to give you the gist of what we taught, because we not only taught them, but we taught them how to teach others and how to expand this teaching across the countryside of Ethiopia, I'm pretty sure that they will be able to tell the basic content of what we taught. And not only that, they might even be able to, it would not surprise me if there were a few phrases that they could even cling to and say the exact wording. Now, to complicate it or make it even more fun, we would teach it in English, in Amharic, which is the national language of Ethiopia, in Oromo, some of the local languages of Ethiopia, and even in some cases in, how much are we recording? in another language that's probably not, I probably shouldn't say exactly what that language is that we taught it in. Anyway, all of that to say, there were several different languages that we taught this curriculum in. And so it was translated on the spot. So someone could remember our exact voice in a different language. And just by virtue of the fact that it's a different language, they're remembering it, not the exact wording, but the exact content, the gist of it, the voice of our teaching. Now, Jesus taught in first century Palestine, in Galilee, and in around Jerusalem, in Judea, and that was a cultural melting pot. There was Aramaic spoken, probably by Jesus. There was Greek spoken, I like to argue, probably by Jesus. There was Latin spoken. And so at any given context, there could have been translation happening. There could have been various other cultural factors influencing how his teaching was received and how it was disseminated. All of that to say, even though we can't have the exact words of Jesus, I think we can be reasonably confident that his followers preserved the basic contents and the exact voice of Jesus. There are some clues, some indications in the Gospels that confirm this hypothesis. The verb to remember and to remind occurs all over the Gospels. Think about some of the most famous sayings of Jesus, the one that I quoted a few minutes ago. What did Jesus say? This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. The Gospel of John in chapter 2 and chapter 12 and chapter 15 and chapter 16, Jesus specifically says, when the Holy Spirit comes, he will remind you of these things. And the author of the Gospel of John specifically says, the disciples did not understand this when Jesus said to them this in this occasion, but only after he was raised from the dead did they remember. So remembering was continuing to happen in the Christian community. Not only in the Gospels themselves, but in the earliest Christian writings after the Gospels. People like a church father named Papias, who lived 110 A.D., Justin Martyr, 150 A.D., Irenaeus, 180 A.D., and Clement of Alexandria, 190 A.D. So the first 100 years after these Gospels were written, that word, remember, 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 it just constantly comes up in Christian literature. Because Christians were obsessed about remembering correctly what Jesus actually did and what Jesus actually taught. Also, when we have a close look at our Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, another key indication that the eyewitness testimony is accurate, is reliable, is we see a combination of several factors. We see a geographic location. We see a setting, like a kind of story that leads up to the saying. We see the words themselves that Jesus says. So I remember something that, so my dad is still alive, and I remember something that he told me when I was 18 years old. So that was what, I'll give my age away, but it was like, 14 years ago. Can't do math. Yeah, 14 years ago. And he told me, Jacob, you're going off to university, and I just want to leave you with some words. Read your Bible every day and exercise every day, and that would take you a long way, okay? It was at my home church that I grew up in. It was on a Friday night because my church had this tradition of whenever the high schoolers, secondary school students, were graduating and moving on to university, they had a little party for them. Those parties were always on a Friday night, and the parents would kind of give a blessing to their children as they were sending them off. And my dad gave this speech on that setting, and I wrote it down in my Bible that I was given at that time. So that was in Macomb, Michigan in 2005, and I was 18 years old. It was at the church on Clinton River Road, and I can't give the GPS coordinates, but location, time, setting, emotional feeling in it, all of those factors make my memory of that saying very, very reliable. And I'm probably going to tell my son something like that when he leaves for university. And I can tell him that my dad told me that. And maybe he'll tell his son. And that tradition can faithfully be passed on because of these factors. When we see the Gospels, we don't see sort of free-floating sayings collections. Just some wisdom teachings that some sage taught, thousands of years ago. We see Jesus going to the, in Luke chapter 4, going to the synagogue in Capernaum and reading from the scroll of Isaiah, unrolling it. Actually, it says unrolling the scroll and reading it, then rolling it back up and saying, "Today, this reading has been fulfilled in your hearing." And then I think it says he sits down. So there is a historical, there's a geographical location, there's a setting, all of those other factors fitting in to give this reliable sense that this memory could have been and very likely was preserved accurately. Now, I don't know if so. There are probably some in the room here who haven't. Do you not know what you'd think about the Christian faith? And maybe there's not a room in your imagination or worldview at the moment for a Holy Spirit, someone that we can't see, but who is divine. But within the Christian framework and worldview, there's also the theological, the working of God in the world. There's also that perspective that the Holy Spirit could actually bring back to memory the things that Jesus said to his disciples. That might not be convincing outside of the Christian worldview, but if you sort of inhabit that worldview, even for a split second, you might see that if we can establish that a God does exist, there would be a mechanism for that God to ensure the preservation of the words that his Son has spoken. I might leave that for another day because that would involve other debates about proving God's existence. Okay, so for at the moment then, let's I'd like to sort of hopefully satisfy the criteria for beyond reasonable doubt by concluding for the second reason that the apostles and their followers and other eyewitnesses remembered the words of Jesus well into 40 years after Jesus' death and alleged resurrection, and they recollected these memories in community regularly. These stories spread and created a culture of shared memories of Jesus. And Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, these Gospels were written in this setting, in this milieu of faithfully preserved, authentic voice and actual deeds of Jesus of Nazareth. So, the first reason to believe, I think, that the Gospels are trustworthy are that they are based on eyewitness testimony. The second reason to believe that, I argue tonight, is that that eyewitness testimony bears all the signs of reliable eyewitness testimony. Okay, moving on quickly now to reason number three. The text of the Gospels was faithfully transmitted in the first four centuries after their original writing. Now, this question basically is asking, is this part of our Bible, Matthew through John, how closely does this portion of our Bible resemble what was originally penned on probably papyrus by the authors who later were said to be Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? How closely does this text resemble it? Well, first of all, this is in English, so it doesn't really resemble it in terms of what language it is. But this is translated from this, what is called a Novum Testamentum Graecae. This is sort of the scholarly edition of the Greek New Testament. But this, let me turn to the end of John. So this right here is based on hundreds and hundreds of manuscripts. And these manuscripts are collated in a very elaborate scientific way, and they are laid out sort of on the table, well, in the old days actually on the table, but now on computers, and the coherence in those manuscripts goes back to an archetype, which is arguably the earliest that we can get. Now, being completely honest, there is, no surprise here, there is indeed variation. There are changes in that text across the centuries. I think if there are Christians in this room, I think we need to acknowledge that. When we hear skeptics like Richard Dawkins and others say that there are differences and there are corruptions, there are changes in our text over 2,000 years, we have to honestly say, yes, there are changes. But almost all of those changes are at what I would call the micro level. In other words, an extra and there, or a then there, or an extra and so, or maybe a misspelling in different words. But one of the remarkable things of the textual witnesses of these four Gospels is that the sequence of the stories is nearly unanimous. Matthew chapter 1 begins with a genealogy. Matthew chapter 2 is Jesus' birth. Matthew chapter 3 is Jesus' baptism. Matthew chapter 4 is Jesus' temptation in the desert. Matthew chapter 5 through 7 is the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 8 and 9 is Jesus' miracles. Matthew chapter 10 is Jesus sending out his disciples. Matthew chapter 11 is giving this this declaration of rest to God's people. Matthew chapter 12 is Jesus walking through the fields and his disciples picking grain from the fields. Matthew chapter 13 are the parables of the kingdom. Matthew chapter 14 and 15 are some more miracles and feeding of the 5,000. Matthew chapter 16 is the declaration of Peter that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and so on and so on. There are no manuscripts where Matthew chapter 13 comes first and Matthew chapter 1 comes third. Or even not only the chapters, because the chapters were invented in, I think, 1561. So there wasn't even versification before the 16th century. The stories, what scholars call pericope, or we can just call them paragraphs, those paragraphs appear in nearly unanimous order. And the only two instances in the Gospels that we see where that does not take place is John chapter 8, verses 1 through 11. Actually, it's John chapter 7, verses 53 through 8, 11. And then Mark chapter 16, verses 9 through 20. And if you look at any edition of the Bible, they are honest. And they say some of the earliest manuscripts don't have these portions. Now, that might be kind of upsetting to some for their faith. Think, oh my goodness, is this an original to the gospel? Or it could actually be strengthening to the case of the reliability of the gospels, that only in two instances has the sequence been disrupted. So the sequence of paragraphs with all the manuscripts that we have of the gospels seems to suggest that even just as I have recalled chapters 1 through 16 off the top of my head, that Christians throughout the centuries have been able to memorize that sequence and faithfully copy that sequence and pass it on generation to generation to generation. So, I think then, beyond reasonable doubt, that it is safe to conclude that these gospels were faithfully transmitted throughout the centuries. Now, admittedly, if you look at the bottom of this section, so right above where it says reason four, those manuscripts might seem like they're few. 11 of Matthew, 3 of Mark, 5 of Luke, 16 of John, and I alluded to hundreds of others. Actually, I think the count is just over 2,000. Once we get to the 4th century is when you see sort of like a massive proliferation of all of these manuscripts. But before that, all of those key witnesses that we have, they agree on those paragraph sequences as much as is present in those manuscripts. If they're just a few verses, they agree with the paragraph sequence. If there's several chapters, they agree with the paragraph sequence. And if we put all of those together into a big picture, we see that macro level stability. So concluding this section briefly then, I'd like to argue that we have reasonable evidence to conclude that these manuscripts preserve the original sequence of paragraphs and even the basic wording of the early texts. And Christians actually had the standard that they got from the Old Testament. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 2, Moses says to the people of Israel that if anyone adds to this law, to him will be added the curses. If anyone takes away from this law, the same kind of curse applies. Revelation chapter 20, the last chapter in our New Testament canon, has a similar, what they call, inscriptional curse. If anyone takes away from this book, his name will be taken from the book of life. If anyone adds to this book, the curses will be added to him. So adding and taking away was this motif in early Christianity that made them very reticent to tamper with the text. It was a reverential act of preservation that usually took place when the scribes, at various levels of proficiency, because they were fallible human beings, but underlying that all of the process of transmission was this deep theological commitment to preserve the words of God. Okay, finally, reason number 4. The first 3 reasons that I gave were very, historical, very much concerned with evidence, and very much concerned with evidence that can be analyzed, that can be weighed, that can be judged, that is, to a large extent, objective. I'm trying to make an objective case for the reliability of the Gospels. But as human beings, we also have subjective reasoning that involves our affections, that involves our emotions, that involves our hearts. And so reason number 4, I'd like to argue that the 4 Gospels are aesthetically beautiful, and they present a picture of the world that makes sense of evil, of wrong in the world, of justice, of human flourishing, and they give a solid hope that should, could, is desirable, and it gives us a reason to enjoy beauty. This was actually an argument that early Christians gave when they encountered the Greco-Roman philosophies of their day, because they were very, very sophisticated arguments against the Gospels early on. There was a philosopher named Galen whose influence on medicine went right into the medieval age. People were still bleeding people in the 18th century because they were following Galen's medical practices. But he was somebody in the 2nd century, 100 years after the Gospels, made fun of Christians because their Gospels were so ugly, by his account. Or another guy named Celsus, a similar Greek philosopher who said, John kind of contradicts Luke. Ask me on that later on if you'd like. John contradicts Luke. Matthew contradicts Mark. These Gospels don't make sense. They're all messed up. This is not good literature. We have Homer. We have Virgil. We have beautiful, high-quality literature. Why are these Christians following these backwood, uneducated volumes about a crucified Messiah? And what the early Christians would say is they would say, well, look at them. Look at the picture, almost as if there are 4 corners of the world, north, south, east, and west. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, they tell us this picture of a creator who made a good world. They tell us this picture of a humanity that is messed up, that is killing each other, that is broken, that is plagued by disease, by famine, by war. And they tell us a story of a God who actually comes down into this world and becomes a man who walks this earth and actually bleeds with us and actually touches people who have leprosy. And the leprosy doesn't infect him. His cleanness makes the leprosy clean. This man breathes out life everywhere he goes, and this man even conquers death. Now, just imagine for a moment that that is true. Would that not be good news? Would that not be the most beautiful, or at least one of the most beautiful stories that has ever been told? Now, I'm a big fan of the movie The Fugitive. Harrison Ford, I just love the sort of sense of justice that at the end of the movie he's finally vindicated, as he did not commit the crime, he's exonerated, he is innocent. Now, at the beginning of the movie, they set up the whole problem when he's framed as having brutally murdered his wife. And he goes to court, and they have the tape, they have the blood, they have all the evidence they need, and the judge says something along the lines of, "We have scientific proof that you are guilty." Now, as it turns out, the bus on the way to prison for his sentence for life, you know, crashes, he escapes, he becomes a fugitive, and he goes from hospital to hospital, trying to gather evidence to prove his innocence. And everywhere he goes, he's healing people. You know, he goes and he gives advice about, oh, you know, this person actually needs that treatment. You know, I'll sign it off there. And then he goes and helps somebody else. And then Tommy Lee Jones is chasing him the whole movie. He's like, I don't care if you're innocent or not. You're coming with me to prison, you know. But slowly and surely, Tommy Lee Jones starts to question his own judgment. Why would this man jump off a cliff and dive into the water and escape? That's not how guilty people act. Why is this man giving medical advice in that hospital and people's lives are being saved by him? That's not how guilty people act. Why is it that every one of his family members that I have interviewed has said he would never do something like that? And why is it that at the end of the movie, when he's thinking that he's finally proven and captured Harrison Ford and going to take him and give him justice because he's guilty, but the real murderer is behind him, and Harrison Ford ends up saving Tommy Lee Jones's life? He's saved by the very person that he's trying to convict. Finally, he realizes this person is not only innocent, this person is giving life everywhere he goes. I'd like to argue that when we put the Gospels to the test, we take them to court, we weigh whether they're guilty of falsehood, of deception, we actually need to notice that these Gospels are bringing life everywhere they go. I know, I've probably lost count, maybe it's about 20 now. People who follow Jesus now, they believe him with all of their hearts, and because of their faith in Jesus, they have been kicked out of their homes. They come from Muslim backgrounds. And side note here, this is not at all to promote any kind of Islamophobia. The work that we were doing in Ethiopia was not only a Christian work, promoting the message of Jesus, it was also a message of peace in the public square so that Muslims and Christians could live together in the same country in a peaceful way. I wholeheartedly believe in that important neighborly calling that anyone of any religion has. So I don't want any way to promote Islamophobia. But I'm talking from a Christian perspective where we firmly believe that we have a message that is important for the world to believe. Now, these Christians, these followers of Jesus who come from a Muslim background, have lost everything. Because they say they follow Jesus, the Messiah, their family kicks them out and threatens them with their life, saying, "You're no longer my son. It is worse to me to have a son turn to Jesus and become a Christian than it is for a son to become a murderer. It brings that much shame to my family. Get out, leave, never come back." But something in those Gospels compels the Muslim to do that and to finally accept Jesus, the truth in them. It may sound outlandish, but there are actually hundreds and hundreds, actually now there are thousands of cases of Muslims when they read this text, it coincides with dreams they have of a man dressed in white saying, "Come, follow me," and speaking the words of those gospels. And even imams who have studied and written long books discrediting the gospels and showing every single case where there is a contradiction in the gospels, when they experience the beauty of it, something in them changes, and they're willing to sacrifice everything they held dear to follow this man, Jesus Christ, who is speaking through these gospels. There is power in this story. Not only is it what I argue tonight, does it stand to the test beyond a reasonable doubt of historical scrutiny? I also want to argue that it is profoundly beautiful and compelling, and it is the message of hope to the world. Thank you.